Hey, it's Steve, and this is Luminous, a podcast series about psychedelics from To the Best of Our Knowledge. If you hang out in the psychedelic space long enough, you'll run into a few really thorny questions. Like, what's the relationship between Buddhist meditation and a psychedelic journey? Both can take you deep inside your mind, they can change your life, and they both come out of long spiritual traditions, so you might think there'd be a lot of shared DNA here. And for plenty of people, there is. But I've also talked with some prominent Buddhists who don't want anything to do with psychedelics. They tend to regard using drugs as cheating, getting a quick hit of enlightenment without really earning it. And there's one other thing. Depending on how you read the Buddhist texts, there may be a prohibition against psychedelics.
The fifth precept, which is around this idea of non-intoxicant and taking intoxicants that cloud their mind, this is the big debate about, are plant medicines and psychedelics intoxicants or are they liberatory? Do they cloud the mind or do they awaken the mind?
This question is one reason Spring Washam is so interesting. She's a renowned Buddhist teacher who taught for years at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, and she's one of the founders of the East Bay Meditation Center in Oakland. She also has a long history with plant medicines, and she incorporates Dharma talks into her ayahuasca retreats. That's gotten her into a lot of hot water with some Buddhist elders. I first met Spring Washam at a conference last year. She got up on stage and, with no notes, told her life story, and it was riveting. So when I saw her recently at another gathering, I really wanted to talk with her to hear how she became a Buddhist teacher and then crashed and was saved by ayahuasca and then came back to Buddhism. Spring recently moved to Atlanta, where she started her own ayahuasca church, and she took on a huge challenge. How do you heal racialized trauma? It's an incredible story, and Spring is wonderful company, so I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. So the reason I wanted to talk to you is you have such an interesting personal journey, and you've explored different contemplative traditions, different spiritual traditions, and I sort of want to just walk through that process for you. So were you always someone who gravitated towards contemplative practice? Was there a sort of a particular moment when you thought, this is what I want to do with my life?
Honestly, when I look back now, I can see the very, very deep thread of a spiritual leaning. As a teenager, I was reading all kinds of self-help books. Wayne Dyer, I remember reading Wayne Dyer and trying to meditate in the fourth grade.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah, reading his book, True Magic or Real Magic, something like that. And then I'd say my first real practice community where I got very serious was somebody left the book Man's Eternal Quest on my dining room table when I moved to Oakland. I remember, I'll never forget that. I moved into an apartment, accidentally left it on my dining room table. And I remember at 23 reading that book. It was all about meditation. And that's when I really committed my life. I recognized I'm a spiritual person. Oh, this is the life I'm supposed to live. And it was kind of this whole revelation.
And when did you start to dive into Buddhist practices?
Not long after that, I studied in the Hindu practice, self-realization fellowship, Paramahansa Yogananda school for a year. But without a teacher, I felt at a disadvantage, without a living teacher. So I would practice, but I wasn't getting the, I didn't feel like I was growing. I spent hours and hours and going to the temple and doing 3-hour meditations, but all I did was think about all my problems. Hmm. But I needed a technique. So when I heard about this 10-day retreat, very randomly in the desert where they taught you meditation in silence, you practice all day, I signed up not knowing anything about it, not even knowing it was Buddhist. Hmm. And that is where I was introduced to Buddhism, insight meditation. And then, of course, I met my teacher, Jack Kornfield, who has pretty much had the biggest influence on my life, I would say, of any being I've ever met.
What did he do? What opened up for you working with him?
Well, on that retreat, I just remember hearing him teach, and there was a deep resonance with the teachings of presence and insanity and how to be with my emotions in my mind. There was a naming of my direct experience of like, I'm living with this chaotic hell, you know, in my head. Oh, you are too? Oh, okay. Oh, it's actually a diagnosis. It's actually, you know, it was this opening to this wisdom of the suffering. So I really resonated with how he taught, because he was a teacher that was very heart-centered. And I think I have that same inclination to be rooted in compassion and wisdom. And then he just really took me under his wing. He saw my passion for the practice. And for right after I met him, for about 10 years, that's all I did was
for
practice.
For 10 years?
Yeah.
Wow. And you were practice with the intention of becoming a teacher yourself?
No, I never even had an aspiration of that. Not at all. I practiced because I felt so terrible. And I wanted to understand why I suffered. My family was a total disaster. My father was crazy off on his own. My mother was married to this really abusive man. I hadn't lived with them in years. Everything was just suffering and pain. So I really wanted to understand why everybody was so sad, why there was all this addiction. I wanted to understand why life was so hard. And so that was my whole motivation, was how do I become happy? That I really cared about that. And how do I love this life? And this was all in my early 20s. And I thought, you know, this is the time to understand. And I was deeply inspired by these texts I was reading, in the Hindu texts, and of course, these Buddhist texts, which talked about freedom through these practices. And I was starting to taste it. And so then tasting it makes you want more, right? So I started going on 3-month meditation retreats at Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. I went on a 9-month retreat there at a refuge they'd built in the forest. I went, traveled all through, did a pilgrimage, the holy old school pilgrimage, and studied and traveled all over, going to many teachings. And for a long time, I followed the Dalai Lama of New York and San Jose and back anywhere he went, even though I didn't even understand it. I was so drawn to monasticism. During that 10 years, I was always entertaining the idea of being a nun.
To be a nun in the more of the monastic tradition,
yeah,
or as part of a larger
community?
Just
to be a just to practice with that level of devotion. However, it was always the needs of my community that would pull me out of that trance state of being like, I'm going off for myself, goodbye world, you know, and go to Burma or go to Thailand or go to Nepal. And it was always the suffering of the people around me that would be like, it would somehow pull me out of that. I thought, well, maybe this lifetime I'm really is service. Yeah, and then I had no interest in teaching. They had to talk me into teaching. That was never my motivation. It was always just to be of service. And when I was younger, there was no teaching as a career like there is now. There wasn't like whole teachers coming up and being like, I'm going to base everything on a mindfulness teaching career. That didn't even exist. There was like 3 teachers and they didn't look like they had any money and they were working on donation. So that wasn't an aspirational career. The teaching came out of me just sitting there and being asked to share and then being asked to share again. And then I started an organization in Oakland, all donation based. So I never tried to become that. In fact, I've always pushed against it a little bit.
So for the people who came to you, you know, who showed up at your house in Oakland, were they doing that because they had particular issues, problems that they were dealing with? What would you say was the attraction for the people?
I always was fascinated by that. They were really, really interested in working with their mind and also finding inner peace. Not long after that, we opened up East Bay Meditation Center, which was a nonprofit, donation-based, generosity-based economics. You know, it was basically like a Buddhist church, right? And we taught all classes constantly. I was a resident teacher and everybody would walk through those doors. And I was always asking people and they were just like, I want to be happy. I feel sad. I don't want to feel this. And people were starting to equate it with their own mind. Like, there's a way I'm thinking. There's something I'm doing. There's something I'm not relating to my emotions. People knew suffering. They didn't have the words to describe their experience. And when I was able to give language to it, it was like, oh, these are the Four Noble Truths. This is how you be with pain. This is how you be mindful of terror. This is how, you know, I was teaching all these skills in a way that came straight out of the Buddhist tradition, and people needed those skills.
Why do you think that mindfulness healing work is so effective in dealing with people's unhappiness, with their suffering? What is that doing for people? How does that open people up?
It gives people a way to compassionately deal with their own mind states, bodily sensations, and emotions. They need a practice of liberation. We need a practice of freedom. We practice mindfulness every day to be sane. They wanted to be there, right? And this was a technique that is so old, right? 2,500 years old is this Vipassana, clear seeing meditation. And I would teach them, this is a lineage. This is a new age, guys. This is not what you know, because a lot of people, they had to know it was rooted in a powerful lineage. And this isn't something we invented yesterday. And that's a, you know, that there's a long history. And I began to teach the lineage and people began to study that. And they found a lot of relief. I always tell people to look at the Buddha as a psychiatrist. Like, who doesn't need a good psychiatrist to call? This is going to be your psychiatrist. You're going to call them once a week and you're going to look at your mind and you're going to try to feel better.
And what is your, I assume you have a daily practice.
I do.
And can you summarize what you do?
Yeah. So I think it, you know, it kind of vacillates and sometimes it's less steady than others, but usually every day I try to sit for 30 minutes and then I try to do a physical movement practice as a minimum. And for me, it's like food. It's just, I notice if I go 2 days or 3 days, I notice that my happiness level isn't the same. I notice that I'm not flowing with things, right? I'm starting to get graspy, resisting everything, just the being alive, waking up out of bed and going, no, I don't want this. Not even knowing what I'm saying no to, you know, it's just like a no to existing. And then often I do heart practices. I also do mantra practice a lot. So I'll take periods of day where I'll do heart mantras, Om Mani Padme Hum, which is the compassion mantra. And then all throughout my day, and I'm not kidding, I try to practice awareness of my body to try to keep my presence in my body because I'm moving fast, I'm working a lot. So when I get up and down, I try to remember, feel your feet. I was doing it all yesterday at the airport. I was practicing on the way over. I was doing metta on the plane. And if I didn't do that, I wouldn't feel joyful.
So I want to pick up your personal story. So you had developed your own Buddhist practice, basically, as a teacher. You were well-known, recognized. At some point, you shifted direction and got interested in psychedelics and plant medicines. How did that happen?
Well, I think what happened was after really, really practicing seriously for 10 years on the Buddhist path and using all the practices, I was on a long retreat. I'll never forget it. It was when Obama was elected. So I know it was 2008. I was doing concentration practices and I fell into a very deep trauma spiral. Now, they didn't know a lot about trauma like they know now. You wouldn't believe it. It has been like a liberation of insight and growth on trauma. But in 2008, when meditators lost it, they were told to just calm down and go back and meditate. Or they were told to get off meditation for a day, go for a walk, eat heavy, and then you'll be. And also, people who had to leave meditation retreats due to trauma. I knew a lot I had in process, but I didn't know that then. I thought I had cleared the decks and, you know. And
I mean, it's so interesting to hear you say that. I mean, here you had been teaching first. I mean, you sort of become this master teacher yourself. And yet this stuff started bubbling up for you.
Oh my gosh, it did. And I was ashamed at that time. I remember I was finalizing my teacher training. I was supposed to have all the answers. I had a center and was right in Occupy Oakland was going on. I remember just all these things where I had to be this super leader, right? In the midst of it, have all the answers. And at that time in Oakland, a lot of our community was wild activists. You know, it's not easy to run that ship. It's not easy to steer it, right? You have people who are just, so much energy. And I fell apart in a way that I hadn't before. I was in terror, and I left the retreat early, and I didn't realize I was disassociated at that time. Like, I had totally disassociated, and I was trying to understand my own trauma myself, because people didn't know what to do. And I felt deeply embarrassed to go to the teachers who had trained me and put me on this pedestal to be like, well, now I'm freaking out. And, you know, I hid it. And so I remember at that time, all that came to me at that time was, you need a shamanic intervention. I had no idea what that meant. And one of my very closest friends, dear friend of mine, who also serves medicine and had just started working with it, I called her and she said, I have been working with this plant called ayahuasca. It's a vine. It grows in the jungle. And I thought, honey, what? This sounds so crazy. But I, at that moment, was so down and out. If you would have told me any medicine I could take that would help me with whatever this traumatic energy, because I didn't understand what was happening. I didn't understand why I couldn't sleep, and I was crying for hours, and I was losing all this weight, and I was shaking, and it was terrible memories were coming. I didn't know how to be with it. The first time my practice couldn't meet the moment, and that terrified me. It was like I had no boat, and I'm in the ocean. Suddenly my boat cracks, and you're like, now I have to swim? What do you, I had no refuge for my mind. I had relied so heavily on, I'll just open to it, sit on my cushion, and then it'll all work itself out. I couldn't do the practice. So I ended up getting invited to do an ayahuasca ceremony in my darkest time. And that,
where was that?
This was in Santa Cruz. And it was in Santa Cruz Mountains with a couple of therapists and a guy who was really a beautiful healer from Puerto Rico, and he had been working with the medicine. And so I had my dearest friend, who was a psychologist, singing to me, and I had this other person. We had this small group, and I'll never forget, in 8 hours, I learned more about my trauma and myself than I had in years. It was as if the door to all these questions, I couldn't even explain how profoundly liberating and helpful. And just, it was like healing the trauma. I was seeing it. I was understanding. Because when you don't understand something, you don't know how to be with it. I couldn't figure out why I was doing what I was doing. And I'm a leader, and I'm post. And the heavy weight of the teacher identity was so unhelpful at that time, because I was still only 35.
So can you take me there? I mean, you were so experienced,
meditator.
As a meditator yourself for years. I mean, you had been exploring your own mind, and yet this other experience with ayahuasca did something different. And I guess I'm wondering, what was the different thing that happened with ayahuasca?
It was like when I took the ayahuasca, like I hadn't even been in the game. It was like I was sitting wandering around the field, but now it was like, now you want to get into the real awakening liberation game. And it was like as if the medicine for me helped me to understand that I always had this huge energetic component and multidimensional level to my practice that was kind of shunned by the Western Vipassana world. I was very, very good at jhana practice and meditation. So that because of that, I was kind of like a darling of the it's like if you're a math teacher and you have a student who you're like, yay, they've got the formula. I taught them and they know it, right? And you sort of look to them. So I had all this kind of concentration jhana. And so I had a lot of mystical experiences, but I didn't know how to make sense of those experiences, and neither did the guides, because they hadn't mapped that terrain themselves yet.
So do you think that ayahuasca, I mean, clearly it opened up something for you that you didn't have access to just through meditation. And I guess I'm wondering, like, what is it about ayahuasca or your experience with it that did that, do you think?
Because ayahuasca became like a teacher. Ayahuasca began to walk me through my experiences and help me integrate and open, and where things were not balanced, it balanced them, right? And I began to understand how karma and trauma really worked on my energetic body. Oh, this is how you release it. And then, I mean, my first ceremony, I saw I would go to Peru. I saw I would work with indigenous people. I was so curious about working with it from the source. Like, how does this work? This vine, I want to see where it grew. I want to see how they make, I don't believe it. How is this possible? I was so mystified. And that led me into doing many ceremonies. I started drinking the medicine all the time and I was getting so much better. I started going down to the Amazon and I was staying at different Shipibo places with women healers and working with the medicine. And I was just all it was. It was like a growth spurt that I couldn't even believe of understanding everything that I understood intellectually with Buddhism. Nothing had been integrated deeply. It was a little bit there. It was like 5%. Now we were like going all the way. It was like I was embodying it. And because I had so many years of practice, I was really good at ayahuasca ceremonies. The wildest, screaming, craziest. That's why I ended up living at a Shipibo Healing Center for a year and did great.
Because it's really scary for
it
a lot of people.
It can be scary for a lot of people.
But that it wasn't for you.
It wasn't for me because I relied on everything I saw. It was almost like this Buddha would come into my head and say, everything here, let it go. Arise, pass, feel, really. It was almost like this inner coach through every ceremony. It was like, this is all just a dream. Now this is terror. Terror looks like this. It was like every teaching I had absorbed by all the Jack and Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Amaro, all my Ajahns that I used to study. It was like everything was alive, and that I could pull from that toolbox, and I kept pulling from it, and it made me accelerate in my ceremonies in a way, because then I'm working with the plant. A lot of people, when you're terrified, you go in as an unwilling participant. You're just kind of in the fetal position, screaming your way through it. That's one way to get through a ceremony. But I would really try to sit up and be fully, I was interested in what was going on. It was like, to me, the ceremonies became ultimate meditation practice. And I was so fascinated.
When you say working with the plant, I mean, you felt the intelligence of the plant there.
Absolutely. I felt that I was in the presence of a very powerful, not only doctor, but a very powerful teacher. And the teacher was teaching me through all of the imagery that I already knew, right? It was using everything I had stored up to show me how suffering is caused and how it ends. It was like I had this library of all this Buddhist doctrine and imagery and experiences. And it was showing me in my own previous or my career at the time, I've never not been Buddhist. It was showing me how to heal myself through that lens. It was showing me how to master the Eightfold Path, how to walk the Dharma path. And so for me, I loved it. I never saw it as not Dharma. Every ceremony, I had so much gratitude. It was never boring. And I always saw I had this connection with this plant that was unbelievable. And when I started living with indigenous people, because they had a worldview like that, I resonated with them. They were like, yeah, this is a doctor and this tree is a doctor spirit and you could talk to this spirit. I sort of melded in that world very comfortably. I was like, yeah, I have to get used to no electricity and showers in the river and giant tarantulas. But it was like, but that felt secondary to the inner growth that I was experiencing far for me. That was the easy part, was the lifestyle of living in that with Shipibos in the jungle.
You're listening to Luminous, our podcast about psychedelics from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm talking with Spring Washam, a Buddhist teacher and a healer who works with plant medicines. I'm Steve Paulson. Did you try to figure out, or did you have thoughts about what or who this plant was? I mean, this
all
intelligence.
The time.
I mean, who do you think you were communicating with, or who was teaching you?
That was the endless speculation. And at times I got suspicious, you know, I don't know, maybe I should stop this and go back to I only shouldn't be talking to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and awakened beings. And the plan was like, who do you think this is? If you believe in Jesus, then I'm Jesus. You believe in Muhammad, I'm Muhammad. I am the higher consciousness. And now where I come with that, and I used to talk to the indigenous people about this, and they would tell me, you're talking to Pachamama. That's who you're talking to. You're talking to nature. You're talking to the consciousness. they just looked at it like that. You're talking to the universal intelligent. You're talking to source, you know. And now I really look at it as this, I've come, and this is where I am at this moment. It could change, obviously, with more information. I'm in a growth process. I really look at it as I am talking to the part of my mind that's already awake. It's trying to wake up the part that's lost still and confused. Mm-hmm. And it's always kind of breaking out of storylines, you know, constructs.
So how long did you go down to the Amazon? How many years were you doing this?
Oh, wow. I say my biggest stint down there was from 2007 until 2021.
Oh, wow. So many years. And for just like a trip at a time, or did you spend some time down there?
For a lot of that time when I started my organization, because when I lived with the Shipibos for a year in the jungle, I saw so many miracles because it was like I was a nurse, I was an apprentice, I was at all the ceremonies, helping them, helping the people, calming people down, teaching mindfulness. You know, that's the training, was to watch how these medicines affected people from all over the world, healing from everything, autoimmune disease, cancers, all kinds of mental health disorders, all kinds of addictions. I saw so many miracles. When I left there in 2015, I wanted a Buddhist organization because I missed Buddhism. Hmm. I'd involved myself so deep in that world that now I was like, now I want both of them together.
Well, and I want to ask you about that because, as you know, there's this big split among, I mean, there's not just a single Buddhist community. There are lots of Buddhist communities on psychedelics.
I know.
Some Buddhists say, no, this is like sort of a violation of Buddhist principles, bringing in these, you know, these other substances. And for other Buddhists, why not? I mean, if this helps you get to deeper truths, and how do you navigate that terrain?
Well, I've always just surrendered to both truths being equal and valid. And that's what kind of drove people a little crazy about me in the beginning, is when I was pulled in front of the elders council and they're like,
did you have to feel like you couldn't tell your Buddhist friends that you were
for a long time doing ayahuasca? I did not tell them, because I would just say I'm going on retreat and I would stay in the jungle a month or 2 months. And I literally would do the ceremonies and meditate in the jungle most of the time and do yoga, right? I was doing a retreat, but yeah, I did, because it was so controversial. People were so afraid, and there still is this fear that's kind of, we're coming out from the cloud of it, but I think it was just a lot of fear around indigenous people, a lot of fear around losing control, but I went through a lot. I was always getting in front of the elders council. I had teachers filing complaints on me when I would do public talks. People demanded I took my website down. It was okay for them when I was doing it for my own mental health, my own well-being, and I didn't talk about it. But when I decided to open a retreat center and bring and live in the jungle 6 months of the year and then 6 months in California and do my retreats. So now imagine I'm a new teacher, right? I'm a Black teacher. I'm already like the youngest, the only part like to come on this council of elders that had been together. They were already like, okay, we opened the door and now you're going to do your retreats in the jungle with ayahuasca after we train you for 10 years, right? And I was like, yeah, isn't that a great idea? they were like, no, that's not. And I was still teaching.
Did you push back when they said that?
Yeah, I didn't, but I never pushed back hard because I really understood the concern. They were like, somebody could die or this could happen. I thought, you're right. This isn't Theravada Buddhism. I was like, you're right. On these nights, we're not doing classic Theravada Buddhism. I would agree. We're going to drink ayahuasca on, you know, instead of Dharma talk on this night, we are going to do these ceremonies. But I think at some deeper level, there was some trust. Because they didn't just fire me or kick me out or denounce me. And then there was a group of people that really fought for it. We were a small, mighty few that were like, no, we will. This has some real validity. And because of those teachers, because they were also some of the founders, they kind of allowed for me to stay. But I think my reputation was tarnished. And even though I never fought back, I told them I will do my retreats, I will keep my website, and I will never change my biography. And I've always encouraged these organizations, go with the wave. Why don't we open to it, you know, instead of maybe shutting down? And so there's various concerns around that, but I've deeply respected everyone's view. I've always said, thank you for sharing. I've answered every question. I've protected myself with legal things. I've done everything. I've did all the work in South America so there wouldn't be an issue of you're doing something illegal because it's totally legal in Peru. So I did all those requests. And then at the end of the day, I have to live my life. And so I ended up only recently in the last couple of years, I ended up trying retreats in Costa Rica. And then I started slowly making my way back to like being rooted in North America for this time. Like, you know, I thought I would live in Peru or Costa Rica, but I feel like more and more how I got to Atlanta as a thick rooted down there. And it feels like the right time with this whole psychedelic movement.
Yeah. I want to come back to that, how you got to Atlanta. But so when you were doing these retreats, were you melding, combining sort of, you know, working with ayahuasca with your Buddhist practice?
Sort of like,
so
absolutely.
How, in what way do they work together or are they complementary?
For many years, up until very recently, I led 14-day retreats and I would make six ceremonies, depending on the group. And on our off days, we had Dharma talks, meditation throughout, studying. We would have all these amazing different Buddhist texts available, and we would do Dharma reflection. And so at the beginning of the retreat, when they would arrive, we would take the precepts. And then during the ceremonies themselves, I would often co-lead the ceremonies with a Shipibo maestro. So it was always also a lot of Amazonian influences. We'd be doing all the healing work and flower baths and all the things that was required for ayahuasca retreat. But I would be reminding them, we'd have Dharma talks before the ceremonies, reminding them on bodhicitta or to compassion. Or I would think, okay, tonight we're focusing on the first level of mindfulness, first foundation, embodiment. Let's come back. And I would help people get in their bodies during the ceremonies, right? I'd remind in the middle of the ceremony, I would stop and say, feel your breath. Sit up if you can. Claim your body. Feel your body. Bring your awareness fully in. And so that began to infuse, right? Everything had a weave, and people would say that, oh, the Dharma teaching yesterday was so alive in me during the ceremony. So for me, that was just natural because those were my practices. Right. I generally was just doing what I felt in the moment. And then I had no idea so many people were going to like it and be like, coming on board for the Buddha. Even people that weren't even Buddhist were like, I'm really into this Buddhist thing. I was like, you weren't Buddhist, you know? And they're like, no, but I am now. And
you know what you said? I mean, it makes so much sense what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, why not draw the best from different traditions? Yeah. And yet there's so often resistance to this kind of thing. And I guess I'm sort of wondering why. Is it that there is, I mean, for a lot of people, there's sort of a purity in a particular tradition or, I don't know, integrity of a particular, you know, you don't want to kind of dumb it down or sort of corrupt it in some way. Like what? Why aren't more people bringing together different traditions if they work?
Well, I was influenced by Santo Daime, the Christian ayahuasca church in Brazil. And that's all over the world now, the Catholic. I think they're more of a Catholic, but they were blending Christianity with ayahuasca. How wonderful, right? I was like, I didn't feel that what they did was wrong and nobody else, and it was legal in the U.S. So I was influenced by them. I was like, well, why can't we have a Buddhist ayahuasca ceremony? That was so great. Then that ticks my box because right, I'm already doing that. Mm-hmm. And I used to give medicine when I remember coming back from a lot of my Peru trips, I would bring medicine back with me and I would share it with my Buddhist friends. And we used to call ourselves the shamanic Buddhist. We had a little club and we met like once a month and we would drink the medicine and we would take refuge and we would pray. And then we would talk about Buddhism at the end of the ceremony and be like, the nature of mind and none. And we would have these like debates about philosophy, you know, emptiness and form and who is ayahuasca? It's a Dakini. I loved it. It was so my thing. So I think there's a fear around ayahuasca being appropriated in a totally different way. And even though it's kind of normalized with the Daime church because it's been around 100 years almost, you know, it's like a long time, right? But there's also a fear in Buddhism where it's like the fifth precept, which is around this idea of non-intoxicant and taking intoxicants that cloud their mind. This is the big debate about are plant medicines and psychedelics intoxicants, or are they liberatory? Do they cloud the mind, or do they awaken the mind? Because clouding the mind is very different than awakening. Alcohol is not liberating. I'm not into that as far as like drinking heavily on my retreats, but that's a different association when we talk about intoxicant versus a medicine. And so I think for a lot of people who have never done any of it, that conversation for them is unclear.
Are there different metaphysical systems here as well? I mean, when I think of ayahuasca and sort of the traditions that you've been talking about, the plant as teacher, really communicating with this, I don't know if spirit world is the right word. Is that also true? I mean, Buddhism is a big tent, a lot of different Buddhist traditions, but is there that same sense of spirit world in the Buddhist traditions that you've worked in?
Yes, I think for all of our, in the Buddhist traditions, I think what happens though, again, with a lot of these traditions, when they meet the Western science world, they become deeply secular, right? So then pretty soon Buddhism gets stripped out of the magic and it just becomes fixated on what? Mindfulness, right? And science and brain imagery. And all the magic of the whole lineage somehow, and all the texts and the sutras is, oh my God, if you read the Pali Canon, which is the short, middle, and long discourses, it's full of magic. It's like, what? They built this bridge and they went up to the God realm and gave the Buddha's mom medicine and drove back and then they were here. I mean, it's like, oh my God.
It's so interesting you say that, because, you know, there are all these people who are, you know, very sort of believe in Western science and all of this and say, you know, Buddhism is the one spiritual tradition that the atheists love.
Exactly. Because they haven't read it, really. They've just been doing certain practices. And you can focus on aspects of it. And the great thing about Buddhism, it's like a buffet. You take what you need and you can leave the rest and get by, right? You don't have to eat every dish there to have a nice dinner. You can just take a little this, a little that, a little of this, and you can go a long way and feel a lot of happiness and a lot of joy and a lot of peace and contentment. However, if you want to open up to the true nature of this world, I mean, even in the suttas of the great night of enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, they said they recalled a 10,000 world system of seeing everything, a 10,000 world system. And we know the universe, even every day they're finding universes on top of universes. On this thing is a lot bigger than any of us know. So to hold on to any narrow view and to go, I know what this is and it's that. You know, I feel like we're constantly breaking that, and we're breaking that, and we're breaking that. So I just invite people to take what you need. And if you don't want to know all the mystical things, or you don't want to believe that, you know, you don't have to subscribe to that to practice. You can just follow a simple path of just looking, working with your own heart and mind and doing the best you can to be here. And you know what? And that's great. I mean, most people aren't even doing that. They're not waking up every day trying to be a good person. I mean, I celebrate anybody who's on any path of like, do no harm and actually try to be present.
So you mentioned that you are now living in Atlanta,
yes.
Which seems like a different world than everything that you've been talking about up until now. So how did you end up moving there?
I mean, I could really tell you it was Harriet Tubman. Yeah, I wrote a book about Harriet Tubman during 2020, had this whole very profound connection to that ancestor and wrote all about it in a book called The Spirit of Harriet Tubman.
Why Harriet Tubman? What drew you to her?
Honestly, I've always admired Harriet Tubman, but I was never like a Harriet obsessed on Harriet Tubman. I was, who didn't like Harriet Tubman? I was like, oh my God, this woman, Underground Railroad. I mean, I think.
Who kept going back down to the South.
Yeah, went back down and then fought in the war. And then like, you know, 5 minutes a year, we all had a Harriet Tubman picture and go around for Black History Month in February. And that was it. I had that. I learned. Like that little bit. But no, Harriet kind of showed up for me in 2020. I started to have all these mystical experiences, and Harriet was like coming, and the spirit of Harriet, and it stayed with me since then. I feel like it's been a guiding ancestor.
Wow, that is fascinating.
Yeah, it's a whole realm in that. I write all of it in the book, and I'm still making sense of that. My connection.
When you say she showed up to you, what do you mean?
Well, she first showed up in a very powerful dream rescuing me. And then when every time I did any ceremony in any way, Harriet was the theme of the entire ceremony and was guiding me and talking to me and helping me and sharing and basically was showing me our connection and showing me about writing this book about her heart, that she was unknown as a great spiritual being. She was known only in one context because I was, you know, so I said, okay, I'll write this. And I was at the time during the lockdown, I was doing the Church of Harriet Tubman online and inspiring people with messages and teachings. And so that book came out and I was still determined to move to Costa Rica, to my paradise outside of the U.S. because I thought the U.S. is so traumatic. No, no, no. But it was always this narrative in the back of my mind, like, no, no, you go to the South. And I had never even gone to Georgia, only one time. And it was this project now is about being some kind of presence there. I'm, you know, starting a whole project there, but I really
wait, can you describe the project that you're doing there?
Yeah. So again, it's this bridging of these worlds, right? And we're talking about Buddhism and plant medicine, and people ask me to guide them in ceremonies. And that's, I love to do. And I sing and I play music and I have my cosmic band and we do heart prayers and practices. It's my favorite thing to do. It's one of my favorite things to do.
Can I just say though, it's one thing to lead ayahuasca ceremonies in Peru or in Costa Rica.
Yeah.
To do it in Georgia, that's a different thing.
And yeah, and I've been very nervous about that and I'm trying to understand. And so I spent a lot of time, we worked with lawyers and we got our church, right? And our church. And then I started a 501c3 connected to that so I could do all the meditation, the yoga. I could build out a retreat center. And then all and through our church is our sacramental work that's protected. So we founded our church as an ayahuasca church.
So this is legal, what you're doing there?
This is the word legal through the church. Yes, because the good thing about Georgia, what's kind of hysterically funny about these southern states is they've given all this power to the churches, like this unimaginable amount of power. And they opened up a huge back door to medicine churches. So now you have the Mushroom Church of God, the Mushroom Church of Mary, all these churches are popping up, North Carolina and Georgia, a lot. Areas where you have these people are saying religious freedom. This is our religious freedom. These are our ancestors. We have a right. And so we're going through on that religious freedom law and following the peyote Native American churches and following in these other churches that are getting DEA exemptions.
What does it take to start a church? I mean, what qualifies you to start a church that is actually going to be recognized by the legal authorities?
Well, apparently not a lot in Georgia. And that's why you have a lot of these quack churches. And I think they wanted to empower a lot of these like white supremacy kind of these QAnon type churches. They were giving a lot of power to that. I am considered Buddhist clergy. That has been my tax identification status for a long time before I started going to Peru. And then my co-partner is a beautiful teacher named Lama Rod Owens, who went to a three-year retreat in the Karmakagyu lineage and graduated with a master's in Harvard Divinity. He considers himself a preacher. So this is a co-founding of both being Black Buddhist ministers and mystics. So this is very new in Georgia. So I'm taking my time, you know, all the legal paperwork's founded, all the doctrine, and we're slowly going to be moving into presenting programs, but it won't just be medicine, medicine, medicine. It's medicine in a mandala, right, of other holistic healing practices.
So I'm guessing that the community that you're working with in Atlanta is quite different than what you were doing in California, or maybe not. I don't know.
Because
you said there was a reason that you felt like you needed to move to the South.
Yeah, there's like a lot of need for healing racialized trauma and Southern trauma, ancestral trauma. I was always really like, oh, that's too hard. Yeah, that's too hard. That's too triggering. But then with the help of Harriet Tubman, I was like, well, you've got to be strong and you know how to work with these medicines and people need safe places to heal this energy. And it's really deep, the stories. And I want to start telling them, meeting these young people who have been beaten up by police or their families murdered in jail. Just like, a lot of racism directed at them and their terror of living a normal life, feeling that they can be themselves. It's like, wow, it's really a lot stronger in the southern part of Alabama. You know, I'm only an hour from Montgomery. That just seems like the cradle of the Confederacy. It's like, wow, I can't believe I'm here and going to talk about healing work. We're calling our community a little bit more Black-centered, but inclusive of all beings. So it's like if you were going to go to a Black church, you could go to a Black church. There's always a lot of other people in Black churches, but it has that feeling. So I want to center Blackness so that people who are there feel that they're being witnessed, seen. The set in the setting is comfortable. And also a lot of those communities in the South, they like churches. They've organized in churches. The civil rights movement came out of a church. They feel safe and protected inside church energy. So I realized that a lot of the songs then now take on a gospel sound, like just what's emanating, the land pulls it out of me.
Yeah. So you said your first thought was, oh my God, like using plant medicines to work with racialized trauma. That sounded too hard. And somehow how do you think you'll approach that? Or are you approaching it now to use these psychoactive substances to deal with this? Really?
Go right into the heart of it.
It's not just sort of personal. It's historical too.
Yeah. And it's my own family. It's my father. It's my, you know, I'm biracial. My mother is white. My father is African-American, but they were subjected to hell. The stories of my grandmother, like, is like, oh my gosh, you know? So these are stories that I know well and have led to a lot of suffering, you know, unresolved trauma in the family. You know, I thought it was going to be really heavy, and on one side it is, right? But then it turns into this incredible joy. The ceremonies, they started off weeping and tears, and we're in the mud, and it's like, oh my gosh, and, you know, and everyone, we're holding people and singing over them, and it's like so hard, right? Everyone's moans and the groans and the pain and the memories, and it. But as it starts to lift, then this joy I've never known before. It's just like at the end, we're just singing and we're all, and it's like that, it's so good. Oh, this is the payoff. We're, right. We're like, we're going to go into the bottom of the hole and we're like, oh, and we're going to clean and we're all rocking, like, oh, holding each other and so sick and this, and, you know, feeling everything that the psyche is holding, right? But doing it together gives tremendous power. You need all the people together. You need their bodies close together. You know, it's like a movement of energy and it's lifting. And what I notice also when it lifts everybody.
I have to say, this is so inspiring. I mean, just amazing what you're doing. So thank you. This has been such a
pleasure. You're so welcome. I love talking about it. It brings me a lot of joy and it makes me cry because I just also think like, I just want to be a force of good. And so many people do too in this psychedelic movement. So many healers and therapists and people trying. And I don't know if we can make this turn without the use of all these medicines. I think we need them. They're here right now. They're trying to be used. They're trying to, you know, like, hi, you know, they're trying to magnify themselves. And I just pray constantly for the legality and the conscious use of these and the wisdom keepers to come forward and people to begin to hold these and so we can help people. So
thank you.
Thank you.
That's Spring Washam, a Buddhist teacher and healer who works with plant medicines. She's one of the founding teachers of the East Bay Meditation Center in Oakland and the founder of Lotus Vine Journeys. You'll find more interviews on the science and philosophy of psychedelics on our website at ttbook.org/luminous. And I hope you're subscribing to the Luminous podcast feed, where you will meet a lot of amazing people, including Gul Dolan, the neuroscientist who's given MDMA to octopuses, Eric Davis, talking about the history of LSD in the psychedelic underground, and Brian Murarescu, unpacking the Eleusinian mysteries in ancient Greece. Luminous is produced in Madison, Wisconsin. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Sarah Hopeful did the sound design for this episode. And Angelo Bautista is our digital producer. I'm Steve Paulson. Be well and join us again next time.